Hey, Berto, I thought we would respond to emails because, you know, every once in a while, listeners will email us, and I have been neglecting to respond to many of them, so I thought we'd respond to them. What do you say?
Lo hacemos juntos.
Welcome to the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist. I'm a licensed therapist, and I'm a professor.
My name is Humberto Castañeda. I'm a retired three-legged racer.
So let me just do some announcements first. If you could donate, that would be good. My cats are trying to kill each other again. For some reason, whenever we start the podcast, where we record, they like to join us. Mm-hmm. And there's this big open space of carpet where they like to roll around, and my cats hate each other. And so it's prime real estate or an attractive nuisance, if you will, for my cats to interact and try to kill each other.
Maybe they have like psychology topics they're trying to get out, you know?
They're trying to demonstrate it through interpretive fighting.
Yeah.
Well, so if you could donate, that would be good. Also, the CEUs are up if you need continuing education credits or units, as they call them. They are on the website. A few people have done it, which is good for me. I have to pay a fee to do it, so it'd be good if a lot of people could do it. My big scheme here is that I could make the podcast into continuing education for licensed professionals so that you can listen to your podcast and at the same time get continuing education. And so if you do it, then I will do more, shall we say, academic type content, more professional development content that requires me to spend more time prepping for it, honestly.
Right.
And so if people do the continuing ed and pay for it, then I'll do more episodes like that. But if you don't, then I'll get the picture and I'll just do Tougher Bluffs for the rest of my life.
Can I get continuing education from listening to myself? Like, can I just record myself talking about psychology and like?
Also, I'm currently writing a few books, and so I will be announcing those when those are done. Hopefully, they'll be
done. That's incredible. I have so much respect for anyone who writes more than one page.
Oh. Well, I don't know if I deserve any respect until I actually finish the thing because there's a good chance that I'll wimp out and never finish.
Well, you know what they say in Mortal Kombat. Finish him!
Oh, right. I could say the same to you about your piano CD.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Hey, I'm about to put out a CD, though, for my other band.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. But when are you going to bring out your piano CD music?
This year.
It's like Billy Joel-ish kind of stuff, right?
Yes.
This year?
This year.
You've been telling me that for 6 years.
I know. But this is the year.
Yeah. Also, you could review us on iTunes. That's always nice if people review us directly on iTunes because it pushes us up in the ratings, I think. Honestly, I can't tell how the ratings are done. When I look at other podcasts that are above us in the rankings, it sort of boggles me how it works out, because some of the other podcasts that are ranked above us have less reviews and they're not as good reviews. You know what I mean?
Oh.
And so I don't understand.
Well, I go in at least once a day and I upvote all the other podcasts like tons of times. So right. I don't know if that helps or hurts. But.
Probably hurts. Oh, but
okay. Well, it helps them.
I'm not an internet expert.
I'm helping the community.
And by the way, did you get my email about asking? Okay.
I'll look at the stats this week.
Because I want to know if our listenership has gone up from 15,000.
Right.
Because normally we have 15,000 dedicated weekly listeners, and I want to know if we have more.
Yeah, I'll take a look.
More. You know, it's always good for me to imagine that because sometimes when we're doing this, I think, you know, is anyone listening?
Right.
Is anybody out there?
Is there anybody in there?
I just wonder. And then it makes it all worth it when I see the download numbers. And it's hard to interpret these numbers, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have a bot set up also to auto-download our podcast 15,000 times a day from different locations.
Ah, so you're the one.
I'm the listener.
Also, I posted new pictures on the website, so you can go there.
Did you say nude?
Nude, new pictures, yeah. My arms are nude.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
My face is nude.
Oh, I haven't seen your picture. I should check out your picture.
My face is totally nude in that one picture I posted.
That's pretty risque.
Yeah. So, also, I thought I would provide a conclusion to something that we talked about for a long time. Mm. I wanted to, I asked the listeners if I should go with Dr. Kirk or Dr. Honda.
Oh, yeah.
Remember
right.
that?
I
like,
do.
Should it be Dr.? I wanted Dr. Kirk, honestly, because you got Dr. Phil,
right.
Dr. Laura.
Dr. Kirk.
Dr. What's Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew. Dr. Drew. There's a number of doctors.
They doctor, by their first name.
Dr. Ruth.
Dr. Ruth.
And they never go by their last name. And these are iconic figures.
What about Dr. Freud?
That's true. He went by Professor. He liked being called the Professor, which I wouldn't mind being called either. But, you know, it's just that the arrogance in me wants to be in the, you know, to go down in history as
a doctor,
one of those people. But after getting lots of emails and lots of in-person feedback, I decided to go with just Dr. Kirk Honda.
Yeah, actually, that's fine. That's great.
Really?
Yeah, I like it.
Everyone that emailed had something other than Dr. Kirk or Dr. Honda. Everyone was like, how about Dr. Kirk H? Or how about...
No, listen, I here's the deal. I'm not marketing, so fine. Maybe I'm wrong. But it sounds less gimmicky to do your full name. Like, it just sounds less gimmicky. It sounds like you're actually more legit, you know?
Well, I'm okay with gimmicks.
Well, then call yourself Dr. Spanky. Wait, I want to be Dr. Spanky. What's the minimum work I have to do to get a doctorate?
To get a doctorate in spanking?
In anything. So I can call myself Doctor, and then I'll call myself Dr. Spanky.
You'd change your last name to Spanky?
Yeah.
I think you could change your first name to Doctor and your last name to Spanky. And
oh, well, that's easy.
Circumvent the whole...
What is your doctorate in? No. I'm Dr. Spanky. I know. What's your... No. I'm Dr. Spanky.
Who's on first? So let me ask you a question before we get any emails, because this has been bothering me. Is it weird when your friends poke you on Facebook?
I mean, the poke is just like, hey, I haven't seen you in a while. What's up, right?
Is that what... I don't know what it means.
It's a, I want to reach out to you. I don't have anything to say, but hey, what's up, you know?
Shouldn't that be a ping?
Well, but poke, it's like, you know, it's like tapping on your shoulder.
But who does that in real life? Who walks up to you?
First of all, I don't do it on Facebook, and I've only been poked a couple times.
by friends, right?
Yeah. Well, but not by close friends.
Right.
It's friends that I haven't seen in a while.
Are they flirting with you?
Well, one of them, yes, because I know it was a girl, and that is, in fact, what was happening. But there's been other times where it was just like, I haven't seen them in a while, and it's a poke.
I've been poked by a few people or more than that, and I'm positive that a number of them were not flirting with me.
Okay. That's a little, like, to me, it's a little like, if you don't have anything to say, then why are you reaching out? But maybe I'm being biased. I don't know. Like, if I'm reaching out to someone, I'll at least be like, hey, I haven't seen you in a while. Like, literally just like point it out, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe they're being ironic or something. Like, it's
poke.
Like,
you know what I'm going to do tonight?
But.
I'm going to go through and poke everyone.
I wonder if there's
an experiment.
They should have a button where it's just like just a
poke everybody.
A blast poke.
Blast them. I'm putting everyone on blast. No, I'm going to try it and see what happens.
Yeah.
And I'll report back.
Spam
poke. This is an experiment. Spam poke.
Yeah.
I have like, you know, whatever, 400 people. I'm just going to poke everyone.
What about your mom? You got to poke your mom?
Yes. Everyone's getting poked. It's massive pokage.
All right. Let's get to the emails. So, just a global answer to all the emails I get. I've received a lot of requests to do various topics, and I promise that I think, anyway, that we will eventually get to the topics that people have suggested.
Okay, cool.
Now, that means I'll be doing the podcast until the year 3,000 and something. But everyone suggests really awesome topics, and sometimes we actually do them. Sometimes I just read your emails on the air. Another person on Twitter actually sent us something, and they said, I don't know why, but they were like, hey, Psych in Seattle, because we're at Psych in Seattle. If you say happiness with a French accent, it becomes a penis. So,
happiness.
So say it.
Happiness.
Right. So, yeah, we always appreciate jokes. Honestly, I never check the Twitter, so I don't send Twitter. I don't send
tweets.
I don't understand Twitter.
Don't twit.
I just don't get it. I don't get the internet. Can you explain the internet to me?
I think it's a plural, internets.
Yeah, because there's more than one.
I'm sure.
There's got to be.
Isn't there like ARPANET or something?
I mean, you have an internet and I have an internet.
Oh, yeah. And is it the same?
Are they webbed together?
That's a good question. If an internet rings in the forest, and you ping someone and you poke someone in the forest and you know, is there someone there to hear it?
Is there someone there to, yeah. Okay, so here's the email. Here's one email that was sent, I don't know how long ago, but a long time ago. So he is saying, my friend, this is an ethical question. Okay, so he's saying, my friend works in an inpatient mental health care facility. He was asked to give a case presentation at the facility on an individual in DBT. It's dialectical behavioral therapy developed by Marshall Linehan at University of Washington just up the road. A mutual friend of ours is currently in DBT as a client and has discussed her therapy at length with us. As her friends. Mm-hmm. My friend wonders if he could use our mutual friend as a case for the presentation. He plans on asking her permission. He also plans on telling her that he will not show her the presentation, which he says would be similar to a therapist showing the patient the therapy notes. He also plans on telling her that he will not show her the presentation because it's similar to showing. Because I'm guessing he's going to be saying things that might bother her in a sense. Because it might be right. Too analytical or something.
Right. My rule of thumb is if you have to email a podcast asking whether something's ethical, don't do it.
No. Berto's the non-professional in the room. It's not a bad rule of thumb, but I don't agree with that. I run into lots of situations where I will ask people and... And I appreciate it when they don't just say that to me. So he was wondering, we were both wondering about the ethics of this situation. Is it ethical for my friend to use our mutual friend as an example for a case presentation?
It's a little too close for comfort.
What do you mean?
It's a mutual friend, someone you both know, right? And psychology is very sensitive, very personal. It's very – so even though you're not sharing the results back with, like, I'm putting myself in the shoes of someone. You come to me and you're like, Berto, I want to like present your messed up mind to my class. You wouldn't put it that way, but that's how I would feel. I'm like, well, I don't want you to like talk about me behind my back to a class about all my crazy dementia.
But what if so this is a good example. So mm-hmm. Say I asked you to talk about you in my class. Mm-hmm. What if I said, I'm not going to give your name, but I know a lot about you and I think it would be an excellent, you know, presentation. I won't reveal who you are, but I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to say.
Yeah. It's different from like, hey, listen, I'm going to talk in my class about people that like, you know, used to be in the three-legged racing business. And, so I'm going to talk a little bit about you. I'm like, that's fine. But if you're going to like talk about my psychology and my personal emotional problems, and I'm not even going to know what you're saying, I'm like, please don't.
Yeah. So, but let's say you say yes.
Okay.
So, because obviously they're saying if she says no, they're not going to do it. But let's say you're cool with it.
Yeah.
How could you be harmed by that, do you think?
Well, okay, just because you don't name names doesn't mean that people cannot, especially because like there's already a three-way connection going on here.
Right.
And these are small-knit communities, I'm imagining. Like, you know, the educational field we're talking about, it's in the same area. How do you know you're not going to at some point interact with these people? And some of the things you say, you could be like, oh, that's interesting. You're the one who's into boating who also murdered your ex we were just talking about you in the classroom, you know?
Right.
And it could just come up and be uncomfortable and awkward.
Right. So that could harm the person is mm-hmm. the confidentiality.
Yeah.
So the person could be harmed regarding that if the people in the audience eventually figure out who that person is. But that's really an issue in any case presentation.
What if I'm just thinking of it from a different perspective. So the person is giving the presentation. What if the things that are brought up, the questions that are brought up, then, like, you know, present this mutual friend of in a different light, and then kind of like it changes the dynamic and it changes their, maybe that's not unethical, but it could risk the relationship a bit.
Good.
You know?
Right. So these are all considerations that one should consider, right?
I also need to know maybe a little more context about the exact type of research we're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know. But when people go through DBT, they typically struggle with personality disorders or with relationship issues. Mm-hmm. They tend to be quite reactive. Mm-hmm. The people who are recommended to DBT tend mm-hmm. to have a lot of chaos in their relationships. Not always, but they often do. They need a lot of help with regulating their emotions, a lot of help with interpreting other people's behavior.
And is the remind me what the DBT stands for?
Dialectical behavioral therapy.
Is the mutual friend is treating their friend?
No.
So how do they have access to the information in the first place?
It must be that the friend has been talking with the therapy is talking with her two friends a lot about the therapy. So here's what I said. So when presenting cases for training purposes, efforts should be made to mask the identity of the client, and or the client needs to sign a consent form saying it's okay to present you your name.
Right.
And some people will present composites. Incidentally, this is what I do on the podcast a lot. I whenever possible, will mix things up in a case presentation when I'm talking about a client, so that essentially I'm talking about a fictional person. But the gist of the story is true.
So nothing you've ever said is believable now, and therefore anything you ever say to me, I'll just ignore it.
It's true.
Oh, okay, got it.
Because I want to mask the identity of clients just in case.
Right.
It doesn't take – I've been doing it for so long as an educator that I can do it on the fly pretty quickly. Right. I can pretty quickly change a few identifying things so that the person won't even know that I'm talking about them.
Do you do this with your friends too? Like, you're like, the other day, Berto jumped off a cliff, although that was really John, but it's fine. It's Berto did it.
Yeah.
And people like come up to me, Berto, you jumped off a cliff. Yep, that was me.
Right.
So here's a question though.
Yep.
Could it also be a situation where would the therapist that's actually treating the person be okay with this? Or are they like, wait, you're presenting my treatment without my consent?
That's interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. I suppose if the presentation was libelous, is that the word?
Mm.
Against the therapist, they might have a concern, but usually not.
Okay.
And that ethical concern isn't usually a problem. However, moving on, the friend of this emailer is not a client of his. Therefore, normal ethical codes are difficult to apply in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a main ethical code that is in all the ethical codes for all the professions, that we avoid doing harm to people, whether they're clients or not, while we're at our jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we're acting in a professional way, we avoid doing harm to people. So in general, one could say that is the main principle that should be considered when this person is considering presenting on them.
It also might matter, like, the degree. Here's an example. So I've said many things on this podcast about my experiences in therapy. And, like, if one day you're like, hey, you know how you mentioned that therapy helped you with this thing? You know, like, it helped you get your contacts renewed more frequently or something, right? I mean, I'd probably be like, sure, mention. I mean, don't name me, but, you know, give it as an example. My friend did this. Because it's not that consequential, right? But if you're like, hey, I want to talk in my class about your sexual abuse. And I'd probably be like, oh, I don't know. Like, well, I won't name you. No, I'm still not comfortable.
Right.
And so I really think that maybe it also matters the context of what about my therapy, you know?
Right. So the main question I sent back to him is, what if she agrees and then later changes her mind and feels harmed in some way?
Mm-hmm.
She could file a complaint, and then you have some questions that you have to answer at that point.
Right.
Now, it sounds to me that if that happened, you would likely be okay, but you don't want to be in that position. So usually when I'm consulting with people and thinking myself, I think, well, what's the likelihood that this person's going to complain? So I talk to her and I say, is it okay? And she says, yes. How volatile is she? How erratic is she regarding her emotions and the way she reacts to things? Sometimes people say, well, she agreed to it, so moving on in life. But really, you need to think about, you know, what's the likelihood that she's going to change her mind? Because if she makes a complaint, even if you aren't found to be in violation of an ethical code, you don't want to go through that. And if she were to raise a complaint and said, you know, a friend of mine presented a case and then five people in the room figured out it was me, and then they ended up firing me from my job,
mm-hmm.
and blah, 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 and, you know, and so you just have to,
right?
You just have to consider that, I guess.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering what if the situation were different and they're not friends, but they're, well, I guess how would they have known about the research? Well, I was just thinking, like, for me, the friendship part makes it an extra little bit awkward, but even if they weren't friends, there's still those concerns about, like, well, can I really be anonymized properly and whatnot?
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, and you can anonymize pretty easily.
Yeah. It sounds like from your perspective that if you're, you know, this person I know, I won't name names, who lives on 5th and Madison right. and her numbers, like that's not good. But right. if you keep it general enough and maybe, like you said, combine or mix up some of the facts.
Right. Well, let me give you an example. I'll just do one off the top of my head. So this is referencing an actual client, mm-hmm. but it's so general that the client probably won't even know I'm talking about them. So let's see. I had a client a number of years ago, and the client wanted to talk about his issues at work with regards to his boss. He felt insecure about the way his boss talked to him, and he was particularly insecure regarding authority given his relationship with his parents and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
So I'm talking about an actual person that I know in my mind, mm-hmm. but how many people have those issues?
Right.
And
it's pretty generalized.
Yeah. And the person that I'm thinking about, if they were hearing this.
It's Bob. You're talking about Bob. He was telling me the same thing yesterday.
Damn it. So another email here, listener Zachary writes, Professor Honda, I am a 28-year-old New York-based therapist in a private practice setting, and I completed my social work master's in May and received my LMSW a month ago. LMSW, licensed M social worker. Licensed M. What the M stand for? Licensed master's social worker? Licensed master's level social worker?
Licensed massage.
I think we have that in Washington too. We have MSWs, licensed masters in social work. That doesn't sound right. But anyway, what is it, Zach? Listener Zachary, tell us, what does LMSW stand for? But anyway, 28-year-old New York private practice social worker. Psychology in Seattle is my favorite podcast.
Ooh.
I enjoy all of your episode formats, whether you are discussing a psychology topic, interviewing a guest, reviewing a movie, or bantering with Umberto. It's the
banter.
It's the perfect blend of professional interest and personal entertainment.
Licensed master social worker.
Licensed master. Licensed social. Licensed master.
Licensed master social worker.
Interesting.
I don't know why.
P.S. You may have, I mean, because the thing is there's not usually doctoral level, so why isn't it just LSW? You know what I mean? Plus, you know, anyway. P.S. You may have mentioned it on one of the podcasts already. I haven't listened to them all. But if not, I'm curious how you came up with the name of your band.
Ah.
And I want to get to your band. I thought we might talk about all our band names we've ever had.
Yeah.
So my current band is Bread Knife Incident. And how we came up with it was I wanted to start a band. Berto and I were in a band previous to my current band, and we thought about every little detail. We scrutinized everything. Berto and I are both like alpha male kind of people.
No, we're not.
Alpha people, I guess you could call us, because there's alpha females, if you will. And we're both also super nerdy, and so...
Well, technically...
our shows were overthought. We brought tons of equipment and videos and lights, and we coordinated our outfits, and the video was perfectly synced with the song, and the drummer had a click track.
It was awesome.
And we had pre-recorded little bells and whistles, and it was crazy. And so the next band I was in, I was actually in another band in between called the Living Room Butchers, and we were a cover band because I just wanted to play music.
Back to basics.
Yeah. And we literally only played in my living room, and we had concerts in my living room. And we were called the Living Room Butchers. And so out of the guys in that band, I thought, hey, let's start, you know, like a garage band. And I really wanted it to be just low budget, lo-fi, don't think, just, you know, I don't even want to write songs that people will like.
Yeah, yeah.
Because in our band, you and me, Berto, we were trying to write music.
Yeah, pop music.
Yeah, we're trying to write music that people would like.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, I don't, it's too much work. I just want to play loud music. Yeah. I don't care if anyone likes it. And so our first practice... The bassist came and he had cut himself, you know, what he was cutting a bagel, and he sliced his finger open, and it was making it hard for him to play the bass. And so we said, well, how about bread knife incident? And the three of us kind of looked at each other and was like, oh, okay. It wasn't one of those moments where we thought.
It wasn't a eureka.
No, it wasn't like, oh my God. Well, it was just like, yeah, whatever. And I think in my mind, I thought, well, that's a temporary name. I'm sure we'll change it. But anyway, so that's how we got to that name. That's your band is called Plastic Poly. How did we get to that name?
Plastic Poly. Yeah. So, naming has always been so time consuming and difficult for me. But what happened is
why?
Well, because I actually believe I have this schizophrenia about names. I believe in the power of a name to kind of convey an idea in a
simple. You mean dissociative identity disorder around names?
Oh, sorry. That's what I meant. No, but so, okay. So some names are so simple and powerful and they convey a thing, right?
Like U2? Okay.
Well.
The Beatles?
No.
Devo?
No. Those are all counterexamples.
Pearl Jam?
No. Keep going.
Nirvana?
No. Well, okay. Nirvana, though. Nirvana is a good example because Nirvana is actually like a word that has a meaning, right? And it's simple, it's catchy, and like you could think, hey, they're reaching Nirvana through the drugs or something.
Well, right. Well, the first time I heard the band name Nirvana before they were big, I thought they were psychedelic rock. Because Nirvana.
Nirvana is, yeah.
Like it's like Indian. Heaven.
Eastern philosophy. Yeah.
Right. I just thought, oh, they must be real trippy and stuff. And then I heard them and I did not like them because they were terrible like before their big album. What's their big album? The Kid and the Pool.
Never mind.
Right.
No, I'm saying never mind. Don't worry about it. Well, okay. So you've given a lot of counterexamples, but there are some powerful examples, right? Like, so Nirvana is definitely one of them. I'd actually argue that Apple is also one of them, even though it doesn't sound like you could think of it like, well, Apple, that's just so common and stuff like that. It is. It is actually powerful because it's like everyone can immediately understand what an apple is. And it has a lot of symbolism to it, right? And it means it's natural. It means it's obvious. It means it's good for you. It means it's aesthetic. It's well proportioned. It means a lot of things that you don't have to explain. And it's just apple. And it's simple, you know, apple. All right. So there are other names like, you know, when you think of, what's it called? Movies like, you know, Inception. It's like a one word name. And if you know the meaning of the word, you're already like, ooh, you're implanting an idea. You're doing something, right?
That TV show Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is a terrible name.
Terrible name. Yeah, yeah.
Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Right.
I mean, I would understand Unbreakable, but that's a terrible name too.
But then Memento, that's a good one, right? Yeah. Memento. Okay, so the point is that I actually believe in that. But the flip side is all the counterexamples. This is what I was saying. I had associative, dissociative, disordered, the blah, blah, blah. Because like Beatles, the Doors, the Eagles, the whatever, right? As long as your band is good, your name actually doesn't matter so much, right?
Yeah.
But, so when I started this last band, we started texting, me and my guitarist, Eric. We were like, all right, dude, we need a name. All right, well, we need something simple. Let's not overthink it. We spent months texting back and forth. We had these long lists because we were like, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And at some point, we started veering towards, all right, here's the thing, though. We want something that's like, you know, we're writing pop songs and they're kind of like simple and whatnot. And so I think we started thinking it's like plastic, you know, it's like synthesized and it's pop, but it's good. It's useful or whatever. Right. So then we were thinking like plastic. That's good. Maybe we could call ourselves Plastic. But then that was like, we weren't quite fine with it. And then we were also thinking of Nirvana because we wanted to write some songs like Nirvana too. And then we were like, well, Polly wants a cracker. And then, oh, maybe it's like Polly. Maybe Polly. We call ourselves Polly. And then through various combinations back and forth, at some point, I thought, well, polymer, it's like a plastic, right?
Yeah.
So what if it was just like plastic Polly? But I'm sure it was like, we tried many variants of that. And finally, we were like, okay, Plastic Polly. And that was the one that stuck. But we probably went through like 1,000 names.
Yeah. I think it's a great name. I think it doesn't describe your band.
It doesn't in the end. In the end, it doesn't. And
because it sounds more psychedelic. Sounds more 60s.
Yes, exactly.
And you guys are more garage bandy.
Totally. And the thing I liked about it, which has nothing to do with the band or the music or stuff, is the alliteration, I think.
Yeah.
The papa.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Plastic Poly.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's a great name. Are there other band names called Plastic Poly?
No, there's a book, a children's book called Plastic Poly.
Huh.
Yeah.
And then our band before that was called Missionary.
Missionary, yeah. So this one is funny. We inherited this name from my previous band, but the previous band inherited it from a very short-lived previous band. And the only reason that name was the name originally is because, again, we were going over email back and forth with the guitarist and the drummer and myself. And we were throwing out ideas, and I threw out like hundreds of names and stuff. And then my guitarist was so fed up with the whole thing. He's like, I don't know. Like, it could be any word. What about like missionary? And I was like, well, that's a great idea. I love it. And then I started building a lot of concepts around it. But in the beginning, it was just, he threw it out. It was so, like, just, what about missionary?
So tell the truth. I know you well enough to know that you definitely have a pleaser side to you. And you also have a side to you that's like, oh crap, I might be losing this person and this project might fall apart. So here is my idea. You're going back and forth with that person, mm-hmm. and you're like, you're into it. You're like, mm-hmm. you're throwing out ideas, right. And you're thinking you're collaborating in this, yes. in this like really collaborative, nice way. Mm-hmm. And then your friend starts to decompensate, mm-hmm. you know, their morale starts to go. And maybe they're even giving you the message that they're a little frustrated that mm-hmm. you are too brainstormy, mm-hmm. and they're like, I don't know, and you're like, oh crap, I might be losing this person. He throws out missionary, and you're like, okay, I better agree with something and establish something now, or else I might lose this whole project. Was that going through your mind?
Oh, of course, definitely, because this is funny. So again, even though I believe in the power of a name, at the same time, I just wanted to pick a freaking name, right? Right. And
but am I right in that up until that point you were like trying to be creative?
Yeah,
together,
I wish. Yes.
And then this person was losing morale, and you're like, crap, I better just like agree with this.
Totally. I wish I could find the email thread because you could probably see it in the thread.
Yeah.
And then finally, the funny thing is they didn't end up being happy with the name because they didn't really mean to make an opinion. But I was like, that sounds great. And to be honest, it did sound neat to me because it's one word. And even though in the end it haunted me because everyone who heard it was like, oh, you're a Christian band.
Yeah. Or they thought it was a sexual position.
But that's the one I was okay with.
Well, and then when we made our CDs, they accidentally mixed our CD with the actual Christian band. And remember some of our CDs in the jewel case. This is back, people, when we actually still made CDs. We have boxes in our closet.
Yeah.
And they actually mixed a Christian CD. We don't know why they did this, but it's like they think maybe it was because our name was Missionary.
Yeah.
But I like the name Missionary. I think it's a good name.
Well, you know what it meant to me is I watched The Mission, the movie The Mission, back in the 80s with Robert De Niro.
Robert De Niro.
And, I mean, that was such a powerful movie, right?
Yeah.
But to me, missionary, the connotation for me had less to do with the religious part of it. It had to do with going into the jungle and exploring, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, that's so cool. I'm a missionary, right?
And you're from Colombia.
And I'm a Colombian, right?
You had a lot of missionaries go through your
zone. That's right. And you know, it's a sordid history, but I thought missionary. You're in the jungle. You're encountering all these wild beasts. And
did it have to do with
amazing.
You moving to the States? And
I was a missionary here, right?
A Columbia missionary.
Yeah.
Before that, I was in bands called Stew. I that was a big band I was in the early 90s, STU, all capitals. And we were at a restaurant having margaritas at a Mexican restaurant in Wallingford. And we're trying to come up with band names. And my drummer, Chris Huber, whom you know, mm-hmm. threw out the name Jerry Mathers and the Hooded Claw. Do you know who Jerry Mathers is?
Sounds familiar.
He's Leave It to Beaver.
Okay, yeah.
So Jerry Mathers and the Hooded Claw. And the other two guys, we were a four-piece band. The other two guys in the band loved it. They were like, oh, that's the best name. And I'm like, that is the dumbest name. Because I was still wanting to be kind of serious at that point.
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
This was like the Smashing Pumpkins.
Right.
Nirvana, all that kind of stuff. And so this was a time when I at least wanted to have a band.
Oasis.
That was I wanted a real band, you know?
Yeah.
And Jerry Mathers and the Hooded Claw that's like calling yourself Dr. Demento or Weird Al Yankovic or something. You know, it sounds like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so so I threw out the name Stew.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how it came to my head, but I just thought, how about stew? And then everyone seemed to like it. And then I just sort of strong-armed it. And like, oh, great. Everyone loves it.
Everyone loves it.
So let's do it. And I didn't like it at the time, but the thing also was in the mid-90s, everyone was coming up with these really long names. Jesus and the Mary Chain.
I was just going to say.
Neutral Milk Hotel.
Right.
You know, these really long, and every time I would think, I was like, oh, what's that band? Like that milk band where there's a band like Milk. And you know, like, you know, a name like Green Day,
right,
or Nirvana or Mudhoney. Like these are easy things.
The
Police. These are easy things to remember. And Jerry Mathers and the Hooded Claw. I was like, no one's going to remember that.
The Claw people. What are they?
Yeah. There was like a Jerry. Claw. And so I wanted to go against the grain and have the shortest band name of all time. And three letters, you know, is pretty short. So, and then it could also be, we could have albums, which we did, where an album would be PID or Dent or
just all, postscript, or how do you call it?
Suffixes.
Suffixes. Thank you.
Or, STUV, cause STU are in the alphabet together. Anyway. What other band names did you have?
So, and you'll love this one. This was 95, 96. So mid-90s. So we were looking for a meaningful name with lots of layers, right? Well, at least I was. And so I was like, all right, all right, I got it. DeSybil.
DeSybil?
DeSybil.
DeSybil?
DeSybil.
DeSybil?
DeSybil. Listen. DeSybil.
DeSybil?
DeSybil.
Like
decibel.
Oh,
decibel. Decibel.
It sounds decibel. Like, so this is my friend Sybil. We call her decibel.
Decibel.
Like, so you're here's DeBerto.
Here's how it was spelled. D apostrophe S Y B I L or whatever. Because here's the thing. Sybil is an oracle, right? A Sybil is an oracle.
I did not know that.
Well, you should have, because we were the oracle, the bringer of the knowledge and the truth, right?
God.
So, and so it's like French style, the Sybil, like of from the oracle, right?
Oh my God.
But it also sounds like decibel, which is of course the mute, you know, like loudness, right?
No, it doesn't sound, so it only sounds like the girl's name Sybil with a D at the beginning.
No, because it's pronounced decibel. Like, what was it? The penis? What was the thing we were saying earlier?
Oh, happiness.
Happiness? Yeah. See, it's all about French. So, decibel. So, basically, that was our conceptual name. And believe it or not, our Asian friend went for it.
Oh, really?
Yes, Mr. Shun went for it.
Interesting. So, next email. This is from listener Rory. He wrote in a long time ago, this was a news story, about Seventh Heaven, the Seventh Heaven Father. He sent in a news story and wanted us to talk about it. So the father on Seventh Heaven, did you hear about this?
Oh, yeah, that was horrible.
He was accused of molesting children.
Yep.
And
there was audio and stuff, right, from his therapy.
Yeah, and I listened to it. Did you listen to it?
Yeah, I did. It was. I wish I hadn't, actually.
Yeah.
I felt very, I felt bad hearing therapy audio. I was glad it came out, but I didn't feel right listening to it.
Well, let's talk about that, because listener Rory asked us, I think he asked about that. It's like, hey, wait, can you like release these kinds of tapes to the public? And the answer is no, you cannot. You can never, no matter what they're talking about. I mean, within reason. But some...
No way. Was it, and it was the wife released it, or the ex-wife or something like that, right?
Right. So if I remember right, he was in couples therapy, and the husband, the father in Seventh Heaven, the show, was talking to the therapist about how he had sexually molested their own children, and the mother and the therapist were kind of confronting him about it, and he was admitting to it. And the mother was secretly recording the session and then released the audio. At least that's the way I understand
it. Yeah, and it was also other children, too. Yeah.
So the therapist is not releasing that tape. So the therapist is off the hook.
And who had the tape, though? Why did she have the tape? Is it common for the therapist to hand copies to?
No, the mother recorded it.
Oh, without, like, anyone knowing?
Without anyone knowing.
Oh, I see.
Right,
okay.
If I remember right.
Okay.
Now, if it was the therapist that released it, that's an absolute no-no. So if the wife did it, then fine. If the, as long as the therapist didn't know it was happening.
Yeah.
If the therapist released a tape, that's a big no-no. Yeah. The situations where you as a therapist can disclose information, which I guess might involve releasing a tape, but I don't, well, maybe, is when, in general, depending on the state and the precedent and stuff, is when we hear about child abuse, we have to report that. So... Right. So in this situation...
Can a court make you testify about murders or things like that?
A court can mandate that you get provide your client records, but client records typically have very little information in it. So there's that. There's also what we call our psychotherapy notes, which are different from the client records, which I won't go into at this point, but it's a complicated topic. And courts can also ask you to get on the stand and talk about things. It's a murky area because in general, in the past, it was privileged information and it was completely confidential. It's only been in the last, few decades or something where there have been mandated reporting laws passed so that people have to break confidentiality. So the old way was, complete immunity, so to speak, from having to say anything. In fact, you couldn't say anything. Right. But now it's a little bit more gray. But in general, usually we don't say anything. So if the therapist had heard this, as it seems like the therapist did, a therapist should have called Child Protective Services. The other situation is when we hear about someone that's going to imminently kill someone or themselves. They can't say, I'm going to go punch someone in the face or I might kill someone or I feel like killing someone, and the therapist has determined that it's not likely going to happen. Someone has to say, I have a way to do it and I'm going to do it. So listener Rory asks, can child molesters be rehabilitated? What do you think, Berto?
Okay, so from what I have in the past read, and it's not copious, but I have read about this topic, plus I will add to that my own... from my own life experience myself of knowing that, when I am attracted to something or when I am hungry for certain types of foods or desire certain types of like pleasure, right? That's not behavior that's easily changed. And I'm talking about things as trivial as like, I like desserts and I like, and it's, so you know how hard it is to change behavior, like stop or eating less or don't have that cookie or don't have these things. And sexual urges, like I have sexual urges every day, right? Like, and mine are of a particular type. And luckily I don't have those kind of, attractions but I'm so extrapolating from that plus what I've read, like, a person that is just, they're not faking it. They are attracted, to the minors, to the little ones. And, their actions are completely, terrible, but the fact is they are attracted to them. They feel those feelings inside and they're not feeling them it's not like the one day that they decided, you know what? I should be a pedophile. I don't like kids, but I should just do it anyways. That's not how it works. And so, it is very ingrained in their desires and in their pleasure reward system. So you don't just easily change that. Plus, I have read about cases where they even went as far as castrating the people, and it still didn't abate the behavior. So sometimes it's not even a sexual response. Sometimes it's deeper than that. So long story short, I haven't seen the evidence that they can be.
Right. Yeah, you said it pretty well. There's a lot of research in this area, and I'm not an expert in it. But from what I understand, the old idea that you can quote unquote rehabilitate someone where you give them a bunch of therapy and then they emerge a different person is a rare occurrence. It can happen. Say you were sexually abused yourself, you work through the trauma through a number of years of therapy, and you find at the end of that you don't have urges to hurt children anymore.
Right.
That can absolutely happen. But as you say, it might be more fundamental to their brain workings, and not and won't respond to therapy in that way. But usually the way that I think people are looking at it is not a rehabilitation model, but a management model. Mm-hmm. Where people will, there's a lot of different types of child molesters, and you need specific treatment around that and specific management around that. So say you're a woman who sexually abuses younger children. Yes, Berto, women abuse children too.
You don't have to tell me. I'm the one that brings up the fact that there's always a teacher abusing a young boy or girl.
Yeah.
A female teacher, I mean.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm just saying that because, you know, joke of like a lot of people women can be doctors too, that right. whole thing.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, plus, what am I talking about? I was abused sexually by a female. Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I forgot.
You forgot?
I forgot my own example.
Yeah. So, you know, say you have a woman that was sexually abusing younger children. And they are healthy in most of their personality. They don't have any other mental illness.
Yeah.
They are mortified that they're hurting people. They have empathy for the most part. And they're compulsive about the behavior and they really like it, but they also don't want to hurt people. Mm-hmm. So if you have a person like that and you get them on board with a management regimen for the rest of their life, where they go to therapy and they go to support groups mm-hmm. and they talk about their urges and they talk about their triggers and they talk about reasons why they shouldn't do it, and they watch videos to remind them to have empathy, to not do these sorts of things. They have outlets to get their gratification in other ways, you know, and so there's a whole management thing, and it's day to day. It's like being an addict. It's
yes,
like being
right.
an alcoholic.
Right.
You don't just one day not become an alcoholic
right.
because you stop drinking. You go to AA meetings for the rest of your life, and you adopt a whole philosophy mm-hmm. that helps you to stay sober. And so that's
and
the model.
Like a non-compromising, like, no, I never dive a little bit into it. I just right. never can. You know, it occurred to me as you were saying these things that part of it, I'll recant a little bit on this front. Like, I think some people might be able to benefit and change from all the systems that you're saying. Part of it, what I think is that if what we're talking about is, hey, listen, I'm going to therapy because I need to go to bed earlier. All right, I may or may not be able to change my behavior. But if I don't, the consequences of that are not dramatic for anyone, including myself, right? But when we're talking about like, hey, I'm going to therapy because I have this propensity to like kill people, right? And I may or may not be successful with the therapy. Well, if the therapy is not successful, the price is really high.
Yeah.
I will kill people,
yeah.
right? So it's kind of like that where, unfortunately, when you if you release someone and say, well, he seems pretty good, but the price is he might go and kill or you know, have sex and potentially, if they're violent, kill or hurt little kids, right?
Right.
And so it's such a high risk. It makes it hard.
Yeah. And again, I'm not an expert on this. And so I'm sure there are people out there that know a lot more about this than I do. But the legal system in the United States is pretty reluctant to just, quote unquote, release them to mm-hmm. the public. You have to get registered. You have to,
right.
you're on a website. I mean, we can look on the internet right now and find the child,
the convicted
sexual offenders or whatever they call them.
Right. Although one thing about that, which I think is, it dilutes the reality is, on that list, you'll also have, you know, there's people that they got convicted for statutory situations where
yeah.
they were 19, she was 16. And I feel like that's a different list. Like that should be a different list, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know the stats, but I would suspect that most of the people on the list are legit mm-hmm. people, because it's not often that people get convicted of quote unquote statutory rape. It's not,
okay.
it's not officially called statutory rape, but. So listener Rory asked another question. What do you do when you find out a long-term friend or a family member is guilty of being a child molester? Berto, what would you do?
Oh man, that's so hard. Wow. You know this long-term person, family member or friend, and you find out, well, the emotional part of me would be so angry and, oh man, and especially if it's the closer that the victims are to you, like you'd be so angry about that, right? And I guess the rational part of you would want to get them into a program, et cetera, et cetera. But I think no matter what, you would want to make sure that you prevent anyone else from getting hurt.
Would you hide it. Would you want to be friends with them anymore?
Well, me personally, it's so hard to answer because if, you know, I'd like to sit here and be like, oh, you know, I would visit them in their program and I would be support. But if it was close enough to me, I'm sorry, like emotionally, I would probably be unable to. And you know, that would actually be overriding my rational side, which says like, hey man, it's just chemicals triggering reactions and, you know, blah, blah. But the emotional part of me would be like, no, screw that. I'm like, I hate this person, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He also asks, as a therapist, what happens when you have a client who admits in session that they've molested a child or that they've had sexual fantasies about children? I'm trying to think if that's ever happened to me, and yeah, it has happened to me, but I knew about it prior to meeting them. They came to me with me knowing that they had this issue. So I don't think I've ever had a situation where someone tells me and I didn't know, you know, they come in for depression or something and then they reveal that they have sexually abused children before. So that's never happened to me. But if it did, I would have a normal human reaction. Like I would in my head be thinking, who have they hurt, and are they going to hurt again, and what can I do to stop that from happening, and can I trust this person, you know, all those kinds of questions.
You know, there's also this whole category of, well, people like me that have been, that as they were growing up, when they were kids, were sexually abused in some way, right? And you know, I consider my situation very minor compared to the horrible nightmare that some people have had to live through. But the point is that I'm pretty sure that we've talked about that statistically, that tends to make you vulnerable to repeating the abuse to someone else as you grow up, right? So that's something that's rarely talked about, that like, man, you know, if you keep it inside that you were abused and you never deal with it, you may end up abusing, and it's all hidden and it's all very hush hush. For me personally, I think it really helped me to go to therapy, to talk to people, and actually to tell my story and confront my story and think through like what it means and how I feel and all these things, because you know, it's like, what if you go through that and then you end up having, I mean, the person that abused me was not an adult. They were 12. So it wasn't necessarily an adult, but still, like, you could end up with a lot of mixed feelings and weird feelings and emotions. And if you don't process that, like, so I feel like that this is such a taboo topic. Like, I almost want to say, like, no, let's talk about it, because even though it's a horrible thing when it happens, if we keep it all taboo and secret and everything, then no one talks about when it happens to them. And then they go and do it again. You know, it's the vicious cycle.
Right. And the main thing that I'll say, if I did hear a client say that, the main therapeutic thought I would have is, well, they're just telling me about thoughts. And so I'm not afraid of thoughts. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I'm not afraid of thoughts. I have heard the style of therapy that I do with a lot of clients is pretty deep, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And the fantasies that I've heard people have, you know, quote unquote, normal people, normal everyday, you know, workers at Microsoft and, you know, Boeing and these places have had some very taboo sorts of fantasies. Not sexual per se, some sexual, but also violent fantasies, just revenge fantasies that they're quite terrified of. And I know enough about the human condition to detect whether or not someone is likely to act it out. And most of the time they're not. They're having flash fantasies about things that are psychologically important to them for some reason.
Right.
And so if a client were to say that they thought about, you know, having sex with a child, therapeutically, I would say, well, tell me about that, you know, and I'm a safe person to talk with about that. I would remind them what my mandated reporting responsibilities are. But I would say, if you're just talking about something and they're just thoughts, then that's not reportable. And unless you talk with someone, and I commend you for talking with me about it, then you're lost in the woods by yourself, and that's no good.
Right.
All right. Well, that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Kind of meandering. Talked about a lot of random stuff.
Meow.
And that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us. And please take care of yourself, because you deserve it.
Goodbye.
Do you want to sing a song?
Oh, yeah. What song can we sing? What was the least controversial topic today?
Nirvana.
Oh, yeah, Nirvana. With
Polly
the
wants
lights
a cracker.
Out, it's... keep singing.
What's the rest of that song?
I don't know.
Polly wants a cracker.
When the lights out,
something is less dangerous. Self.
Here we are
sound
now.
Kind of
entertain us.
Blah, 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 blah.
I feel stupid.
And blah, blah, blah.
Blah, 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 blah. And contain
wait, wait.
Us.
No, stop. How does that song go? Polly wants a cracker. Really should get down herself. Do we not know that song very well? Do you know how many years ago that song came out?
20 years?
23 years? 4 years? I think it was 91.
Scary.
92?